Thank you very much, Bruce, and good morning to all of you. And I'd like to thank the organizers for this wonderful conference. I've really been enjoying it. All of the kind of rich physics that seems to be coming out of the topology of non-interacting fermions. We've seen some examples also of when interactions come in, and I think that's really when things become very interesting for many of us. So the idea in this talk is to think about an insulator which is not which is insulating because of interactions. And so it's a material that, if it hadn't been for the effects of DF hybridization, you might have ended up with some form of an ordered magnetic state or some form of a spin liquid state. But it does become an insulator, and that insulator, it appears, is actually a topological insulator, which means that it can't be sustained at the surface of the material. And the consequence of that is that the surface can become a very interesting place where you can get some form of a quasi two-dimensional, strongly correlated physics appearing. In this talk, we will unfortunately not be looking so much at the surface behavior, but we are laying the groundwork in the sense for thinking about this, and also trying to understand now in somewhat greater detail than perhaps was possible before, the nature of the condo insulating state in a material such as samarium hexaboride. It's work that I've been doing with a big group of collaborators, of whom I'd like to in particular mention my graduate student Wes Furman and postdoc John Leiner. We've enjoyed and benefited from the insight of Pavel Alexeev and Jean-Michel Mignot, who have actually been working on neutron scattering from these materials for a good fraction of their career. We've been working very closely with Terrell McQueen and Syed Kopayeh and some of his students on the synthesis of these materials that are needed for the neutron scattering experiments. And this is work that you can read about in these publications. I'd also like to acknowledge the Spallation Neutron Source where the experiments were conducted, and Department of Energy for funding. So here's the outline of the talk. I'm going to say a few words about condo insulators and connection to topology, something about this experimental technique that we're using, and then I'll essentially focus on the compound samarium hexaboride, spend a little time talking about some of the transport and thermal properties. It's actually a really large topic, quite remarkable that I don't think we heard very much about it yet at this conference. I think probably there will be more about it as we go along. But I'll try to give a little bit of a summary as it connects to the synthesis work that was conducted on this compound at Hopkins. And then the main result is really our study of the excitonic, the magnetic excitonic state and its momentum dependence. And I'll talk about the D form factor that's associated with it. This is actually quite a surprising result for us, that it seems to carry a D form factor, not an F form factor. And then I'll try to present a hypothesis that the scattering, you know, is connected to the Fermi surface through kind of nesting type conditions. I'll argue that it's actually quite a convenient way to look for the topological invariance, to simply look at where in momentum space do you have intensity, and that seems to connect pretty directly to band inversions that give rise to nesting conditions, at least in this relatively simple geometry of this system. And so the claim that I'll try to make is that neutron scattering actually, though it may not directly view the band structure, actually can tell you something about the topology of the bulk. And then, if there's time, I'm going to have a section where I shamelessly try to promote some other work that, in my mind, seems to be connected, other materials where there is the development of a resonant type excitation. I would like to consider the possibility that there's sort of an underlying connection between these types of phenomena. And I'll conclude. So the renewed interest in samarium hexaboride, I think, started with this work about 5 years ago. You know, the topic had been looked at for many, many years. The basic idea is that you have a flat 4F band from samarium, and then a much more dispersive, maybe 4 electron wide D electron band that they cross. And this gives rise to hybridization. And if this hybridization is large enough, and if the chemical potential is at the right position, you can actually get an insulator coming out of this situation. And what was pointed out by this group was that because of the different parity under different parity of the states involved, the D state and the F state, that there's the possibility actually of getting a topological insulating state coming out of this hybridization effect. And the consequence of that would be that there are actually surface states developing and some form of a topologically protected surface of the material. And this has really, I think, ignited a huge interest in this compound. 2 months ago in Michigan, there was better part of a week devoted to thinking about samarium hexaboride. I think what really has kind of caused the great interest to reemerge is that there were a lot of things that were actually not understood regarding this compound samarium hexaboride. And one of the principal aspects of it is actually the resistivity data. And so shown here, plotted as resistivity, that is, considering it to be a bulk effect, one finds that there's a development of an insulating type behavior, but it gets sort of truncated at some point, as if the resistivity just cannot exceed some particular value. And this calls to mind the idea of some form of a parallel connection between two different conduction channels, a surface conduction channel and a bulk conduction channel. And at some point, the bulk may be sufficiently insulating that all of the conduction is actually taking place at the surface. And so just this, the idea that topology was important in the theoretical work had some sort of backing in a really unexplained experimental result that has vexed the community for quite some time. And so several groups then did beautiful transport measurements to actually show that this low temperature plateau in the resistance is associated with surface conduction. So it's not a bulk conduction effect. And here's one of those results by Sayers et al. From 2014, where they take the same chunk of material with the same leads on it, and then they gradually thin it down from the opposite side. And one sees that in the thick, so this is now a resistance ratio that's shown, the low temperature resistance divided by the resistance at 20 Kelvin. And when the sample is very thick, then one finds actually a larger resistance ratio because the fixed surface resistance is now being compared to a resistance of a thicker sample at higher temperatures. But when you come to a thinner and thinner sample, then there's not so much distinction between having conduction only on the surface and using the entire bulk, and then there's not much of a resistance ratio at all. And this has been now confirmed with several other groups that indeed this low temperature resistance plateau is associated with surface transport. Now, of course, this is not a proof that it's a topologically protected surface transport, but at least it is consistent with the concept of this being topologically protected surface transport. Now, of course, one of the things that one would like to see in addition is the weak anti-localization effect that the application of a field should actually reduce the conductivity because time reversal symmetry is being broken, and then the topologically protected surface states now are gapped out and cannot conduct. And this is seen in the bismuth selenide compound. And the story is more complicated for samarium hexaboride. There are important behaviors in resistivity at low temperatures as a function of magnetic field, but it's a much more complicated scenario that calls to mind some form of a domain behavior and indeed some form of surface magnetism, which is actually what, you know, why we came to look at samarium hexaboride. So this is complicated, but good news indicating some form of surface magnetism influencing the transport, which is at the surface at low temperatures in these materials. Okay, so I'd like to say a little bit about the atomic state of the samarium, and also about the variation in the valence of this of samarium across from the bulk to the surface. Because the important question that comes to mind: what is really the nature of the material at the surface? And I won't be able to really pay sufficient detail, put sufficient detail into that. But I'd like to show you this this chart, which shows you photo emission spectroscopy done with fluorescence yield and electron yield, which focuses respectively on the bulk and on the surface. And looking at the bulk, one sees features that are associated with samarium 3 plus and samarium 2 plus separately, so that the interpretation is that this really is a mixed valence state, neither completely filled nor completely empty 4F band, and so consistent with a hybridization between the D and F band of the material. And what's interesting here is that one of those states, the 4F5 state, is magnetic, has a combined spin and angular and orbital angular momentum associated with it. The other state is non-magnetic. So these are the lowest energy J multiplets. And we have to recall, and I'll get back to that in a little, that this is just what's defined as the lowest energy from the Hund's rules. But there are also going to be excited multiplets that can contribute to the magnetism. And in fact, the excited multiplet of the 4F6 state turns out to be related to the magnetism of the material. But there really is evidence from photo absorption spectroscopy that that there are several, that there are two valence states in the material, and it's thought that one is somewhere midway in between, around 2.55 in the valence of the system. And looking at the surface, one finds that at the surface there's actually a preponderance of samarium 3 plus, so that there seems to be some sort of surface chemistry going on in these air exposed samples, possibly an oxidization at the surface that gives a higher proportion of samarium 3 plus at the surface, which would be then in the magnetic state. So there's a good possibility for this material to actually be more magnetic at the surface. And in fact, with X-ray circular magnetic dichroism, we find at low temperatures that that the susceptibility that you can derive from these kinds of data is actually consistent with the paramagnetic samarium 3 plus at the surface.
Okay, is there any significance to the other feature at very low, at lower energies in the bulk?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
This one? That's probably, but I'm not certain about that. I'll have to owe an answer on it. Good. So, you know, we'd been looking for a while at this area of topological materials, and this seemed to be the ideal thing for us to look at. It is magnetic, and we should be able to use neutrons to probe the magnetism associated with the bulk of this material in particular. For neutron scattering, we need typically large, relatively large single crystalline samples, and so it is natural for us to go into to the effort of growing single crystalline samples using a different technique than is usually used for these samarium hexaboride materials. So typically, they're grown from aluminum flux. But those are relatively small samples. The floating zone technique has the advantage of being contact-free and having the ability to actually sweep impurities out of the solid, and so that one would expect that these materials at least have a different type of impurities and perhaps are actually cleaner than the flux-grown materials. They're certainly bigger, which is exciting for us. And in the context of developing the materials for the scattering experiments, we also did various characterizations of them, and I'd like to just share some of those data with you and how they differ from some of the flux-grown samples. So here's a resistance ratio to 100 Kelvin. Red is a flux-grown material. Black is the floating zone-grown material, which actually ends up having a larger resistance ratio, typically an indicator of a purer material with less defects in it, and when you follow this trace of the floating zone grown crystals to lower temperatures, it seems down to 2 Kelvin that the resistance is just continuing to grow. Perhaps it's actually going to become fully insulating. But when you go even lower in temperature, down to 0.2 or 3 Kelvin, then eventually there is actually a saturation that occurs, and this is measurements by Lu Li on the crystals from McQueen and Seyed Kopayeh. And so these materials seem to have a smaller activation gap. The transition into the to the plateau phase occurs at a lower temperature, and also the surface resistance tends to be larger in these materials. And it's not really understood where this difference comes from. If these are indeed topological material, then the surface magnetism could in fact be different in those materials. Otherwise, there are other opportunities in terms of the different surface chemistry or magnetism. Okay, now the question that then came to mind was can we kind of go back from the floating zone grown crystals to determine what kind of impurities could cause the plateau to exist at a higher temperature? And aluminum and carbon were tried, and actually it turns out that with carbon it's possible to make the plateau occur at a higher temperature. And it seems then that carbon has some form of perhaps a doping effect, shifting the chemical potential in the material. And it actually turns out to be quite difficult to get rid of carbon, both in flux-grown and also in floating zone-grown crystals. But there was great care taken not to have it occur in the crystals grown by McQueen and Kopayeh. Another characterization that was carried out, which is I think quite interesting in the context of the recent de Haas van Alpen experiments that many of you are aware of on this material. Specific heat was measured, and it's found quite interestingly that there's actually a larger Sommerfeld ratio or Sommerfeld constant seen in the insulator than the metal lanthanum hexaboride, which is kind of strange. And this seems to be persistent over various kinds of doping. So there is some sort of fermionic degrees of freedom available at really low energies in this material. And I should point out that the magnitude of this effect is actually too large to be associated simply with the surface. It is a bulk phenomenon. And if you follow this to lower temperatures, then there's actually an upturn in the C over T ratio, indicating some sort of bulk correlated physics going on. Which has been analyzed here, but I won't really have time to go into the details of that. But there is some sort of low energy scale that's quite interesting, very interesting, I think, in this material. Now, the experiment that we've been conducting was neutron scattering. Here's the cross section. It allows us to measure the two-point correlation function in absolute units. And one thing I wanted to point out, I'll get back to it a couple of times, is that there's a prefactor that sits in front of all of this expression that we typically call the form factor. And it basically builds into the expression an overall envelope for the entire scattering cross-section that has to do with the character of the interaction between the neutron and the magnetism of the material. So if I end up with, let's say, an ideal dipole, which is a point magnetic dipole, and then this form factor is not going to have any momentum dependence, just goes on to infinite. But once I have a spin density that's extended because it sits in some orbital state on an atom, then I have a form factor that essentially looks like an X-ray form factor sitting outside in front of all of the expression. And so it enables me, if you will, to actually say something about the spatial extent of the spin density, which is scattering the neutrons. Now, when we are thinking about metallic systems or systems that are best described with a band type picture, then typically we'll convert the measured scattering data, which is S of Q and omega, into a dynamic generalized susceptibility. And this is convenient because it relates to the real part of the susceptibility, which can then be connected through the Linhart expression to the underlying band structure of the system. And just as an example of this connection, if you will, between band structure and neutron scattering, here's a case of a compound that I looked at quite some time ago. And here's this is a little bit rough, but it's the only band structure calculation I see for this compound, which also comes up with a Fermi surface and indicates parts of the Fermi surface that connect to each other, and this is going to give rise to a small denominator at certain values of momentum transfer and an enhancement of the wave vector dependent susceptibility. And this group actually calculated that in the case of vanadium 203 and found a little peak at a certain wave vector transfer 1.7, which was consistent with earlier inelastic scattering data, which shows a maximum in the inelastic neutron scattering at this wave vector transfer. And this maximum eventually gives rise to spin density wave instability in the system. So this is a typical behavior you will have when there's a pseudo nesting or an actual nesting. We're going to be talking about an insulator where there's actually no Fermi surface, but still the gap is not very large, and there can be at finite energy transfer kind of a pseudo nesting type effect going on, and this is how we'll want to try to interpret some of the data. Now, in terms of giving you a bit of an overview of the compound and previous work that has been done, which is extensive, firstly, Q equals to zero magnetism. So this is just the regular uniform susceptibility as a function of temperature, and actually a large part of that can be accounted for as a Van Fleck contribution associated with the excited triplet. J multiplet, which is a triplet, and so that really accommodates a lot of that. And so it's maybe not so surprising that the uniform magnetization form factor, which is measured here with neutron scattering. So this is an experiment where you apply a magnetic field, magnetize the sample, and diffract with polarized neutrons from it. And this allows you to measure the Fourier transform of this form factor associated with the uniform magnetization. And it's found to be consistent with the form factor associated with the 4F6 state. It's a little noisy, but you can see it extends out to quite high momentum transfer. Now, in terms of the inelastic scattering, and here I'm showing you work by Alexeyev et al., they actually see a mode sitting around 40 millielectron volts, which is associated with this intermultiplet excitation of the 4F6 valence state of the material. And up at higher energies, it's claimed, it looks a little rough here, but actually looking at some of the original data, one can see why they make these claims, that there actually is also an intermultiplet transition up around 100 millivolts from the 5.5 to the 7.5 state of the system. And Alexeyev also discovered in 1995 a 14 millielectron volt collective mode in the system, and it's the data is shown here, sitting around 14 millielectron volt, which actually disperses through momentum space with a minimum at the R point, the half-half-half location in reciprocal space. And there was very nice theoretical work done by people, including Peter Riseborough, where they interpreted this in terms of hybridization of an atomic F electron wave function with P and or D orbitals from the neighboring state. So that's kind of the interpretation of this feature. Now, it's at this point that with the growing interest in the samarium hexaboroid, we decided that we wanted to try to look at this again. There's a certain challenge associated with looking at very small momentum transfer, but finite energy transfer, which is indicated here. But this has been overcome to some extent with the advent of spallation sources and this kind of time-of-flight instrument, which gives access to very small scattering angles and very high incident neutron energies. So it allows us to probe a different part of energy momentum space than had been looked at before. And this is what we found. It shows you kind of a small slice through all of the data that really is a three-dimensional volume in momentum space. But going through high symmetry planes, one finds intensity at the original location that was previously discovered, but also at the location of the X point, so the half OO position. There's also enhanced intensity of magnetic neutron scattering at this location. And this is important because when it was then possible to see that there's also an inelastic peak at the higher Brillouin zone, point X plus G, so that this mode from that observation can be said to be respective of the translational periodicity of the system, so that it really is a mode that lives on the lattice as opposed to an interstitial type excitation.
So this is 14 MeV?
This is actually integrated from 12 to 16 MeV, just to give the momentum dependence of it. All of this comes when you cool into the insulating state. So this is what it looks like at 100 Kelvin. When you cool into the insulating state, all of these features come out. So they're somehow associated with the development of the correlated insulating state. If I look at the form factor associated with this scattering, one finds that it actually decreases very rapidly with the wave vector. And this is one of the reasons that it's so actually quite difficult to see this. stuff. This is the form factor for F electrons, and that's the form factor describing the uniform magnetization. But all the inelastic scattering follows a form factor that looks more like the 5D form factor. So it's almost as if the dominant part of the wave function contributing is actually a D electron, wave function. Now showing a slice as a function of momentum and energy transfer through the high symmetry directions, you see the intensity at the R point that was previously observed, and now the intensity at the X point. One also sees that the mode actually exists for all the momenta that we've looked at through the Brillouin zone as a peak which disperses through momentum space. It has its lowest energy at the R point, but it also comes down a little bit in energy at the X point. And from fitting these data, we can get the dispersion relation for this exciton, which looks like that. And that indicates that we really have a coherent mode that propagates. We find that its width is below the resolution, or is at the resolution width. We find that the oscillator strength of this mode actually varies through momentum space. And this is important because that shows that it cannot be a conventional crystal field exciton, which has a constant oscillator strength through momentum space. And it actually points towards a band structure type interpretation of these data. Okay, so there are interesting connection to other types of measurements I just want to touch on. The overall sort of level scheme that people deduce from transport and from optical measurements give these kinds of energies. The energy of this exciton mode seems to be the difference between the two. So it seems that this splitting here, in gap state in some way may be connected to the exciton. There's some recent scanning tunneling microscopy data from Hoffman group, which actually also show intensity at the X point that seem connected. And there are Raman measurements for quite some time back, and which are being renewed at Johns Hopkins, which shows the Raman intensity in the same energy range, which shifts with flying magnetic field. Okay, so now I'd like to talk a little bit about what the implications of this particular pattern in momentum space is for the band structure of the system. And what my student Wes Furman did to look at that was he took the simplest possible tight binding description of the system, which would include only the diagonal hopping term. You might expect that one to be important because of the wave function on the boron 6 cluster in the middle, which actually reaches out in the radial direction. So he only included that term and allowed for it to modulate the dispersion both of the D band and of the F band, but with opposite signs in order to have band inversions. And that can actually produce, if you give it the D electron form factor, this kind of pattern in momentum space. And what does that band structure look like? Well, this is the band structure in the HK0 plane, so with the 100 direction sticking up. And you can see the F character of a very flat band and the much more dispersive D band. And then with these with the crossings coming about due to the opposite signs of the hopping amplitudes. And looking at this structure, the natural question is to ask, is this actually a is this a topological insulating state? And because we have inversion symmetry and time reversal symmetry, this implies looking at the parity of the occupied states at the 8 symmetry points of the first Brillouin zone. And the expression looks like this. The gamma and the R point are topologically irrelevant for this, such that it's only the X and the M point parities that are actually significant for determining whether this is a topological relevant insulating state. And these actually do turn out, it turns out that they have different, there's different sequence of occupied states. In the case of the X point, it's the D state that's occupied. At the M point, it's the F state that's occupied. And so these will have opposite parities, and overall there will be an index of -1. So this is a strong topological insulator because X and M have different parity. So that sort of came a little bit indirect through a phenomenological band structure that could describe the Q dependence of the neutron intensity. The hypothesis that we're sort of working with is that because these band inversions give rise to approximate nesting conditions, and here the approximate nesting condition that gives the x point intensity would be the one that crosses from here to here. So having intensity at the x point means that I have a band inversion at this point. Not having intensity at the m point means that I don't have a band inversion at that point. And so therefore, having one out of x and m with intensity would allow me to say that that is a topologically non-trivial insulating state. This is a very simple cubic case, and so I would note it as a hypothesis, a working hypothesis at this point, that there could be such a direct connection between the pattern of scattering and the topology of the band structure. Okay, so then I'd like to I think I have to probably tie. I have 1 minute left, and so let me say that we've been working with Predrag Nikolic to develop a better understanding of the nature of this exciton. It's fundamentally a slave boson RPA, mean field and RPA treatment, which is very similar to what Riseborough did in 1990. But Predrag has worked from the band structure that gives the correct wave vector dependent general isostability, and is able, with not unreasonable parameters, to reproduce an exciton that has the kind of dispersion that we actually observe. So I'd encourage you to look at that work. So I think I'll then want to conclude, and I will have some slides to turn to if it is appropriate during the questions. And then just to summarize, I'd say that for SMB6, we found that the wave vector dependent susceptibility indicates significant body diagonal hopping. That can account for that wave vector dependent susceptibility. We have observed a coherent mode, coherent exciton mode that's weakly dispersive and long-lived. It seems to be visible in Raman and possibly is associated with what is typically called an impurity band. It carries a d-electron form factor, which is quite distinct from q equals to zero magnetism, and actually also quite distinct from most other things that we've seen in f-electron heavy fermion-type systems. In my mind, it seems that this is quite likely to be, in a sense, the soft mode of the surface magnetism. If there's something interesting happening at the surface, it may have to do with the condensation of this kind of excitonic mode. And then sort of the general things that we're pulling out from this, we think that there's a close connection between the pattern of neutron scattering and the topology of the underlying band structure. And this one I didn't really get to, but I wanted to draw some connections between the Kondo insulator and some of the behaviors in superconductivity near magnetic instabilities. Future work that's sort of on the way in our group is to look with higher resolution and to look at the exciton under pressure, where we know that it is affected by these things. And we'd like to probe a broader range of correlated, both strong topological insulators and weak topological insulators. And I'm very happy to be able to talk about this here at Kavli, because we are really interested in realistic calculations of this kind of scattering for comparison with the experiments. Thank you very much for your attention.
So, thanks very much, Colin. The paper's open for discussion. Yes, Rosa?
So I have a question. If you compare your phenomenologically obtained band structure with the band, so Fermi surface, with the one that you obtained from a density functional theory calculation, how different are they? Because then here one can see basically the effects of at least correlation from your phenomenologically obtained.
Yeah, we've compared to some of the ARPA's measurements mostly, and that looks pretty similar, actually.
Yeah. But what about calculations? People have surely done band structure calculations for this system.
Yeah. I'm a little less. Maybe there are others who are more versatile
check
with that. It has been looked at. But I think there's always the concern about the strong correlations of the 4F state and so on, whether that can be.
Yeah, but one could then really compare, so that would be nice, because one can compare. You obtain that from experiments,
yes,
from fitting your experiment, which agrees with ARPA's, as you say,
mm-hmm,
and then one can see how far is a one electron approximation calculation to your more realistic kind of
mm-hmm
one circuit. So
hopefully
it's
more
really
realistic.
Very interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Case.
Good point.
Yeah. So could you go back to your band structure from your Talibani model?
Yeah.
I see that at X point, so then at X point, there's a band, electron band, right, going down. So this is very similar, almost the same with our DFT calculation, yeah.
So you mentioned that there's magnetism on the surface. Does that cause a gap for the surface states? And if so, can you estimate that gap, or is there more evidence?
So that really is the most interesting thing, which I think is on its way, let's say. The thing is that we don't, there's just a lot of physics that underlies that, because we don't know what kind of state will result on the surface. You know, there will be some form of magnetism that comes out because it's not tied up in the Kondo insulating state. But whether it's going to come into an ordered magnetic state or some sort of a Fermi liquid type state in two dimensions, I mean, I think there's a lot of possibilities for that. From looking at the scattering data, this typically indicates what kind of spin correlations are present in the system. And I think in some of the literature, I see people talking about the possibility of a ferromagnetic state, I think because the concept of having broken time reversal symmetry naturally comes out. But from looking at the scattering data, this really doesn't look like a ferromagnet at all. It looks like something that's going to be either an X point or an R point antiferromagnet. So I don't think there's any evidence for this yet, but it would be interesting to look for that kind of surface magnetism that at least had those as the critical wave vectors.
You might have to turn it on. You might have to turn it on.
Okay.
That's good.
So when you were putting carbon, you showed this carbon doping.
Yeah.
Do you think is there a possibility that carbon doping somehow suppresses the magnetism at the boundary? Or because the plateau was appearing, there was more of, I don't know, maybe, does it affect them? If there's a magnetism at the boundary, is it?
I think that's entirely like. I mean, I have to say it's a pretty kind of crude thing, and it's not fully characterized at this point. But it was done in the sense to try to see how can you, what is the connection between these floating zone and the flux grown type crystals, and it seems that maybe there's a connection to that. But I think there's really a lot of things that carbon could be doing. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a way of thinking about it which has to do with shifting the chemical potential, so kind of a doping type behavior. But it's also, and that more relates to what you're saying, possible that it actually modifies the surface reconstruction. Mm-hmm. So that could then influence the nature of the magnetism of the surface. But at this point, it's a little speculative, actually.
Uh-huh. And maybe just one small question. When you're showing this neutron scattering data, is a very stupid question, but is it possible to have at different depths from the, I mean...
Yes.
So then can one see the magnetism building up as you approach the surface?
Okay, that's a good point. So when you said that, I thought it was as a function of energy. So it really is a four-dimensional data set. But
right.
You're saying let's look as a function of real space distance
right.
into the material. And
right.
this would be a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Sounds very
and,
hard.
And it sounds a little tricky, but I think it's going to come. It may not be with neutrons, but maybe there'll be a Ricks experiment done to really look at the surface. But I think that's the exciting thing about this area is that there has been a lot of development in the experimental techniques, and then suddenly there's this proposal that the surface is really different. So I think you're going to see a lot of activity in this field.
Thanks.
I'd like to understand the connection between the topological surface states and then this excitonic delocalized states that you're talking about as and how they might the specific heat where you said there was evidence for some additional fermionic modes. So are you saying that it's these excitonic channel is another independent channel of fermionic excitations?
No. Let me just. The thing is that This is really a different energy regime than what I've been reporting on. So the exciton seems to be some form of a really resolution limited bound state that sits in the system as a long lifetime. And I think it may be the activation of, it seems that it may be involved in the bulk conduction process, because the energy that's associated with it matches the difference between the optical and the transport resistivity. So there may be a connection there. But in terms of the surface, this fermionic type contribution to the specific heat, I think that's not connected because it's too high in energy. So there must be some other interesting physics going on in the bulk in this low energy regime, which I think is seen in specific heat and perhaps related to de Haspin-Alpin, and calls for more experiments in this low energy regime.
Please go ahead. A very good question. So you mentioned in the last slide that there might be a connection between this exciton and surface.
Yes.
What is evidence?
No evidence.
Relating this to the surface.
No evidence except that the bulk magnetic correlations are associated with these wave vectors. So, of course, now things get truncated at the surface and everything is quite different. It's basically an idea that if you were to prevent this material from forming the insulating state, let's say with magnetic field or with pressure, then I would sort of expect these to condense out.
Okay,
and so maybe that's what happens at the surface.
So the data is representative of the bulk?
Yes, the bulk.
Yes, so I wanted to find out more about your thoughts on what are these gapless fermionic excitations in the bulk, or seemingly from the bulk, that seem to contribute to specific heat and to the quantum oscillations.
I'm not sure I want to venture very much into that area. This is really very exciting, and I think there's going to be a talk by Lu Li next Friday, actually, where he will have de Haspin-Alpin measurement, and probably this topic will come up more. I have to say that personally, let's say prior to the de Haspin-Alpin results, we had not really been paying so much attention to the specific heat, and it really seemed that the bulk was pretty good insulator. And so when this comes out, we begin to look for features that could be connected to that. And personally, I think we want to do some more neutron work at low energies. We had really focused on the high energy stuff, but this is really exciting. There might be some form of a charge neutral excitation that's living there.
Yeah. Oh, short question. You showed the inelastic data, and there was the interpretation that there is a transition from J5 half.
Yeah.
And J5 half is not the ground state. So,
What?
It's not the part of the ground state. So, it has to be thermally excited to have a transition from there to other state.
The inelastic data was here.
I was wondering what's the temperature and how.
Well, the thing is that this is supposed to be a mixed valent system with some sort of a superposition of the 4F5 and 4F6 state. And if you had the very naive interpretation, you would say that some of the material at times has total angular momentum quantum number 5½. So 5½ is the 4F5 multiplet ground state. But the transitions that were being examined here were, that was this one. So those are very high energy excitations, which are between two multiplets of the 4F5 configuration. Now, the evidence is a little scanty, but actually, if you look into it, I think it seems reasonable. So the 5½ state was supposed to be part of the intermediate valence configuration.
So the fact that the intensity is very small compared to the previous peak is because of the high energy or because the
this has been built into this line so that the form factor is being taken into account, and this is consistent to the extent of the error bars and so on, with the nominal composition of 4F5 and 4F6, that's supposed to be roughly 50-50.
Okay, so thank you. I'm sorry to the people I've just cut off for questions, but perhaps you can catch Colin at the break, and yeah. So we'll move on to the next talk. And the next speaker is Kate Ross from Colorado State University.